Okay, good evening, everyone. I don't have an accent.
Yes, you do.
I do come from the Midwest. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I do and where I'm from. And this is part two of Inspire, and this is to give you the tools to become a Makarev and Makarevis on your own. And that's what we're here to do. And I'll tell you a little. First off, we live in Muncie. I live in Muncie. I'm married to a girl named Shani Jurevel. These are Rabbi Jurevel tapes. They're both as my father-in-law. My kids are Mekim and Dad Tate on those tapes and those books. I'm married 20 years. I have 10 children, 9 of her, and then my daughter, Big Makarevis, in her own right, sitting over there. We moved from Los Angeles about 2.5 years ago. And before then, I was a Rav for 10 years in Bar Park, actually 7 years, and 3 years in Perth Amboy, New Jersey. At that time, I had a brother who was a minister. His name was Rav Gabriel Klatska. You may have read about him. He was a very famous person. He was makar of many people and was minister at the age of 28. And at that point, I decided to leave the Rabbanus and to go into Kiruv to try to do something more with my life and make a real difference. And Baruch Hashem, I have not looked back, and neither has my family, although it was a little bit difficult in the beginning. But this was 10 years ago when we got into serious Kiruv. We moved to Los Angeles to the UCLA campus. At that time, there were no college campus programs in North America outside of Chabad or Hillel. So this was the first one to open up. It was UCLA. Around the same time, Rabbi Jacobowitz in Michigan opened up a program. And those were the first two programs. The difference being in UCLA, we actually lived on Fraternity Row. Myself and at that time, our 6 children. And over the next 7 years or so, we started doing Kiruv in UCLA, meeting students, stopping them on the walk, just, you know, the old, are you Jewish? Yes, great, let's schmooze, sit down, have coffee with them, invite them to my house, and eventually send them off to yeshiva. And Baruch Hashem, over the years, we've sent well over 1,000 kids to yeshiva, Baruch Hashem, and it's been really gratifying. It's been amazing. My kids have grown up around this, and people always ask, how do you bring children up in such an environment? I'll boast to you a little bit. My kids grew up in on Fraternity Row, and my 16-year-old just finished Gittin for the 17th time. So you can grow up, you don't have to clap, but Baruch Hashem, I just tell you that because people are afraid you're going to bring these people in your house, they're not going to know, they're going to get the wrong message. The truth is, sometimes, I'll tell you honestly, I'm more nervous bringing them up in Muncie. You know, bring them up on Fraternity Row, they saw clearly what was endless, what was shekel, what was right and what was wrong, and Baruch Hashem, I think they came out pretty good. So we were there for 7 years, and as time went on, we moved from UCLA. We started opening up campuses around Southern California, USC, UCSD, SDSU, Santa Monica. I'll be honest with you, before I started Kiruv, I never stepped foot on the college campus. The secret is, people think I'm college educated. I'm not. I'm pure London Tell, Staten Island, Mirror, Lakewood, that's the whole thing. And it was funny, I was sitting in front of, I worked for a number of very big Kvirim. Right now, I was sitting in front of one of them who does not live in North America, and he was turning to me and he was saying, look, you got to be educated. We have to get in the car for a college educator like Rabbi Klatska here. And the other Kvirim said, come on, tell him, I just couldn't bring myself to you. I don't want to break his heart. Anyhow, so that was over 7 years in Los Angeles. And then about three and a half years ago, we were asked by the Wolfson Foundation and Afikim, Rabbi Butler, and others to come to back to New York and to take over all the college programs in North America. So this is what we do today, usually throughout the week. I travel around to different cities. I hire rabbanim. I train them how to do kiruv, and then I go and help them out. And that's my life. And I'm married to an Ish Haschayil. You'll hear more about her in a moment. That's why she's not here. She doesn't like when I speak about her. But if your wife is not in the same boat with you, if she doesn't support you, you can't do kiruv. That's just the way it is. So my wife, by the way, grew up in Barabat, 14th and 45th. She went to Talmud Devora. She went to Beis Yaakov. Not someone you would expect to park herself on fraternity row in California. But Yiddish Haaretz knows how to connect. Anyhow, so we moved to Muncie. And a year after we moved, almost a year to the day, we had a major fire in the house that we bought, and we were burnt out of house and home a few days before Pesach. At that time, we had nine children at the time. The temple was born afterwards. But it was a trying time, but everything Hashem does is for the best. Actually, that's the phone call that I got. I was in Texas at the time, and my wife calls me on the phone. I was in the middle of a meeting. I stopped the meeting. I say, yes, what can I do? How are you doing? She says, great, I just have a question for you. Is everything that Hashem does for the best? I mean, that's not how you want to open a conversation. So I said, of course it is. Why? She said, really, I just need to know. Everything Hashem does, He has a reason for it. I said, absolutely. Okay, what? She said, I'm sitting outside and our house is burning down. Would you like to speak to the fire chief? So that was it, and I flew right back. And Baruch Hashem, we had a good adjuster. We ended up in a hotel in the mountains with our entire family for Pesach, which was actually a lot of fun. And Baruch Hashem, we were able to make a lot of connections, including one of the heads of Inspire was there over Pesach. And I ended up, part of the way, I paid my way through the Pesach as I spoke for that group. I spoke for the hotel a number of times, so he asked me to start speaking for Inspire. So last night was my first time speaking for the product, and today is my second. So we had a chance to rebuild our home, and as anyone who's at the kiruv knows, you really want to build a home that's conducive for kiruv. So I had my dream. What's my dream? You got to have a house that can really knock on the kiruv. So we built Baruch Hashem such a house. We were able to rebuild properly, and we built a house with a dining room that goes on and on and on. And we built we have a table that's custom made, and our dining room table holds 60. We have 60 people considered the dining room table, and Baruch Hashem, almost every week it's full. We have a gepakta house every week. As a matter of fact, just as Shabbos, we had a group from Brazil, a group from Argentina, and a group from Stony Brook, Long Island. And the Brazil group is by us for the week. And that's how it is. And every week we have another group coming from a different part of the country, and they call up, and it's Mamash Gevaldik. And that's exactly how we like it. The kids enjoy it, and it's kiruv the way I always dreamt of doing kiruv. It's not part of my job. I just want to point that out. My job is to teach Makarim how to do kiruv. This I do as a Baal HaBas who enjoys kiruv. And I tell you that just to let you know that the sky is the limit if you want to do. If you want to do. I also want to let you all know before I start discussing how to do kiruv, I just started a project just now. I thought of it Erev Shabbos, and when you think of a project you want to do it, it's got to happen right away. So Baruch Hashem, and anyone who would like to help out in it, whatever you do, we can use your help in kiruv. I can put you to work, I promise you. Just come over to me afterwards. So our project now is, I always get asked by people, Rabbi, send me people for Shabbos. I would love to have somebody, I'd love to have guests for Shabbos. Now the truth of the matter is, it's not as easy as you think. If you're living in my community, I live in the Park Avenue community in Muncie, then yeah, I keep everyone very busy, and I always have guests, because our house, we could seat 60, but we cannot sleep 60. 25 is the maximum, and then my wife won't change any more than I'm here. It's 25, so we scatter them throughout the community. But if you don't live on Park Avenue, you live on Flatbush, I mean, people, it's just not so push it logistically. Then again, I always hear from Bali Tshuva, or people who are not Bali Tshuva yet, where can I go for Shabbos? I just came back from Eretz Yisrael. I've been in town for a month or two. I went to Jewel. I went to Iyad. I went to Neve. And I don't know where to go for Shabbos. I say, come to me. They say, great, that's 1 week. But what about the next week? So thought of a program. As Hashem, you'll hear about it. I'm calling it See You on Shabbos. That's called seeyouonshabbos.com. We own that Earl, and what it's going to be is any family that wants to have guests for Shabbos will make a profile page, and you're going to have your picture, your family's picture. It's going to have a little bit about you, and anyone who wants to find a home for Shabbos, they're going to be able to look you up. So if you live in Connecticut, they'll look at all the families that have signed up, and they'll say, and they have occupations, so if you want to put your doctor, your lawyer, whatever, oh, I'd love to go to this person's house, because he's the Kinderbach Hook, I'd love to try them out, and we're going to be matching up people who are looking for places, and all you got to do is make a profile page. So if you go to see on Shabbos right now, you will actually not see it. We own the Earl, and there was a Shidduch website that I started for Bali Tshuva, who don't have parents to look after them. So see you on Shabbos, become ibashert.com, and that's actually what we use for Bali Tshuva to help them find Shidduchim. But eventually we're going to separate it, so give it another month or so, and you'll be able to have guests for Shabbos, and then there'll be no more excuses, just have them over. Okay. So there's a lot to say about Kiruv. The truth of the matter is Kiruv is like Shas. There are many Masechtas, and every Masechta has many Prakim, and it's tricky and it's complicated. And on the other hand, you can, just like Shas, you can open up to a fifth grader Ilam Metzias, and they'll be able to start learning. So too, you can start doing Kiruv right away, but just to know that there is a Munchus when it comes to Kiruv, and I'm going to try to share some of it with you right now. There are basically three steps to Kiruv, and you have to find out which step is your step. Now, there are some people who can do one, some people can do two, and some people who are able to do all three. Step number one is a step that everyone dreads. That is the recruiting, getting the people. How do you find people? Do you go over to people in the street? Do you look for shalom? Do you look for chai? How do you find people? Recruiting. That's step number one. Step number two is engaging them. And now, engaging them is the part that everyone wants. Oh, I want to learn with somebody. It's not easy, but that's considered the easy part. We still need people to do it. Engaging them can mean having them over for Shabbos. Engaging them can mean learning with them, partners in Torah. It can be a lot of different things. That's engaging them. If you feel you can't recruit, that's okay. You can do step two, but you do have to know that if you don't have anyone feeding you step one, if you have no one recruiting for you, then you're going to find yourself somebody who desires to do Kiruv, but you don't have anyone to do Makarit. And step number three is forwarding these people. Now, there are places that you could send the Baal Tshuva that will help them in the process of becoming from. Now, if they're not married, or even if they are married, you can send them to Eretz Yisrael, you can send them to Asameach, to Aish, to Nemei, Baruch Hashem, in Eretz Yisrael. I help start a program for married couples. That's Midrash Rachel and Chappelle's. They have a program over there in Asameach and Muncie. They just started a couples program. Gateways has a couples program. There are programs out there. If someone wants to go to Chesed, they'll print up all the programs and give them out so that people will know exactly what's out there, because people really don't. They just hear of a program here, we hear of a program there. That's number three. That's forwarding them. Okay. So let me cover each one, and I'm going to do it a little bit briefly just because we're strapped for time. Rabbi, how much time do we have? Until 10 o'clock? Okay, so we're going to do it very, very briefly. Okay, so step number one. I'm sorry? Okay, good. We'll end it at 10 and then we can continue if you'd like, but I'll stop at 10. Okay, meeting people. That is the hard part. So let me tell you a secret that's not much of a secret, which is it's unnatural to go over to a person cold and to engage them. It's an unnatural human thing. No one is good at it. We always hear Mayor Schuster goes over to people at the Kaisel. Well, Mayor Schuster also has to ask them what time it is. He doesn't go over to people and say, are you Jewish? Because it's really uncomfortable to do. That is the truth. Now, so there are some people who are more introverted, some people are more extroverted. No matter who you are, it's still difficult to do. So when people say, well, I can't do it, well, no one can do it. But if no one can do it, then no one's going to do it. And when no one's going to do it, then people will not become firm. So I think in whatever way we can, we have to be mother on our own midas and go over to people, even if it's uncomfortable. Right? There's no busha in front of Hashem. And, you know, always ask yourself, this is one of the great rules that I use all the time. It is the rule to use in Kiruv. You say it again and again. It's always, what's the worst that can happen? Use that. Just say it over and over. What's the worst that can happen? If I go over to a person and then they're not responsive, so they're not. So I tried my best. What, they're going to think I'm an idiot? So maybe I am an idiot. You know, who cares? But at least I went over to them. If you don't go over to them, then, you know, then it's you're not going to be able to bring the people into your home. The truth of the matter is people are a lot more open to a smiling, friendly face than you would imagine. People really, really respond. If for nothing more than they're curious to see who you are and what you're about. And I'll tell you, I once went, I was in Texas actually, it was the same place, and I had worked with the Rabbanim over there to go and do Kiruv on the college campus. The thing is, we paid for couples to go down. It was a koil, it was a Kiruv koil, and the women just didn't have any business. They didn't have people that they were engaged in. So there is a store in a big supermarket in Texas called H-E-B. It sounds like Hebrew, but it's not a Jewish place, but it does have a kosher section, and it also has a lot of kosher food, not in the kosher section. So I told the women, you know what we're going to do? We're going to do a little exercise today. We're going to go to H-E-B, and we're going to get guests for Shabbos. And they looked at me like I just slashed them, like... I said, we'll come, we'll be nice, we'll be friendly, we'll be warm, we'll be open. You will be shocked how open people will be to coming to you for Shabbos. So they all followed me to the store. I said, watch, I'll do the first and watch what I do. And I went over to someone, they were looking at some disgusting, you filled the fish, you know, and the jelly. And I said, oh, you like that? Oh, you know, my wife makes it. She buys a roll and she cooks it with carrots. Oh, really? And with sugar and so on? Yeah, very good. Did you ever have that? No. But you know what? What would happen if I invited you for Shabbat? Would you be open to coming? Sure, we'd love to come. Fantastic. Well, actually, I don't live here, but this lady does, and I know she's an awesome cook. Can I introduce you? And they said, sure. And that was it. I just made the shidduch and bam. So it was so easy that all the women got very excited. So there were four women who were there at the time, and one lady just, she was amazed, got four families in an hour to come there for Shabbat. Another one got two, and the other two didn't get any. Okay, they all tried. Sometimes you got to go over to the right person. Sometimes you just have to give off a good vibe. You don't want to look like there's going to be another notch in your belt, like, hey, another victory. But if you go over to people, they'll be much, much more open than you would imagine. Now, there are ways to find out who's Jewish. And if you've seen any of the Inspired videos or read any of the books, I imagine you're here and you're already inspired to do Kiruv. So you know, you see a chai, you see a shalom. There are a lot of signs to know that someone's Jewish. But a sign is not enough. You got to go over to the person. Now, in case you feel like you look too from, guess what? They really like that. They really like it. Like, because they're expecting one thing, and when they get another thing, they get intrigued. They're interested. It's sort of cool. So that's what I would tell you when it comes to recruiting. Now, you can strike up a conversation about nothing. Now, it doesn't have to be about anything that don't get into Judaism and and halacha. If Pesach's around, say, oh, you have a great recipe for matzah brei. Or if Hanukkah's around, say, oh, you know, we got oil. Do you use oil? Whatever it is to start a conversation, you'll see most people are warm and friendly. It's amazing. So that's recruiting. Now, when you meet a person, if you don't get their name and phone number, then the whole thing is liable to risk. It doesn't work. It's not worth anything. You got to get their name and you got to get their phone number. Preferably their email as well, but you got to get their phone number. Again, if you are warm and friendly, people will actually give you their number. They really, really will. I can't stress it enough because you're not going to believe me until you go over to people. They will. If you're warm and friendly and you say, oh, someone, you know, oh, what a cute daughter you have. I have a daughter just the same age. That's a great conversation start. You'll think, the more you do it, the more you'll see, like, you can really make a conversation about anything. And then after a while, you say, no, we'd love to have you over, or I'd love to do coffee with you. Can I give you my number? Now, they're not going to say no, so they'll say, sure. And then, once you give them your number, so then you say, no, let me take your number as well, and then we'll be able to be in touch. Now, they say, no, I don't want to give you my number. Again, social contract, you just gave them yours. So they'll give you theirs. Now, if you do that, by the way, don't give them your card. If you give them your card, then there's no social contract because the card is too easy. Right? So the best thing to do, even if you have cards, take out a pen and paper and write down your number. This way it shows commitment and then you can get their number. Now I'll tell you a patent Rabbi Kalinowski trick. This works 100% of the time. If you're not sure that they're going to give you their number, this is what you can do. You can say, you know what? It was great speaking with you. I would, let me give you my number and let's be in touch. Sure, I'd love that. Great. Take out a pen and paper and say, okay, what's your name? What's your number? And they'll give it to you. You missed it, right? Okay. Again, you say, here, let me give you my information. Sure. And you take out a pen and paper and say, great, what's your name? How do you spell your name? The reason that works is because they said, sure, they agreed. And then when you took out the pen and paper and you took them down the number, they believed that they misheard, but they already agreed that they would give you their information. So they end up giving you their information. Okay, I used to use that on campus all the time. It never, ever failed. Okay, just say, now, you don't usually have to use it, but only if you're really nervous, and don't worry about being a ramoy. This is pikuach nefashos. You can get their name, you can get their number. A lot of times, people sort of play a game with you. It's sort of like, if you can get my number, and you can read my writing, then you can call me. And you'll give them, if you give them the paper, and say, here, put down your information. They'll write it sloppy, and it'll be the right information, but it'll be in a slot, but I'm sure we've all done that in some sort of form. You know, we put down, credit card, put it down, but we didn't slot. Like, okay, if you can decipher, you passed my test. So if you, what you should always do is read their information back to them. So they give you the paper. If they wrote it, it's better if you get it. It's better if you write it. But if they write it, they say, here, let me give you my information. Make sure you can read it, because one number off, and you're going to be stuck. And that's that neshama gone. Okay? Then, if you're not sure that they gave you an accurate number, so then it's very simple. You can just say, here, let me put it in my cell phone. I'm going to call you, and then it'll be in my cell phone. So then you can call them, and then if they'll say, oh, I think I gave you a number wrong. Okay, then you can make sure. Now, you don't really have to use these tricks. I used to use them simply because I work with so many hundreds of people each week, and, college students play games. Usually, adults won't play games. Either they'll be interested, they won't be interested. But you can ask them for their information, and they will give it to you if you are brave enough to do that. Okay? Now, do I recommend inviting them for Shabbos right away? Not necessarily. We live in America, and in America, sitting down to coffee with people is perfectly legit. Right? As a matter of fact, it's sort of professional. So if you speak to the person, let's say they say, oh, they're a travel agent. You say, fantastic. You know what? I have to go now, but I would love to be in touch with you. I was thinking of taking my wife on a vacation. Do you have any time? I'd love to do coffee. Sure. Boom. You have a meeting with them. It's that easy. America is the land of coffee, the land of Starbucks. Right? To go to someone's house for Shabbos is a little bit scarier, although if you're like really gregarious and happy and wonderful, they may come anyways. But they may say they'll come and then they won't show up. That happens as well. They're more likely to come for a coffee if you make up coffee. And you can think of any excuse to invite someone for coffee. In America, it's accepted. It's a given, no matter what you do. So you ask the person, what do you do? Oh, I'm an accountant. You know what? I've been looking to speak to an accountant. I give time, I'd love to do coffee. See? Almost anything, mommy and me, coffee. So coffee works wonderful. It's the easiest thing to do. You make up a time, you buy a coffee, and then, once you sit down with coffee, then what do you do? So then, that's the next part of cure. Next part of cure is once you're sitting down with the person, you then have to become the world's greatest listener. It's all about listening. The point of your meeting, the point of meeting number one is to get meeting number two. So therefore, if you come down heavy on the person, with halacha, and musar and hashkafa, you'll never see them again, even if you convince them that you're right and they're wrong. You'll never, ever, ever see them again. So the point of meeting number one is to just do a lot of listening. The power of listening is greater than the power of speaking. The world's greatest listeners are the people who are oil of the kedusha. And they're the people who have the greatest friendships, they're the people who have the best marriages, the people who are great listeners. when I got my first Kiruv job, I was interviewed, and the toughest interviewer asked me how much of Kiruv is speaking and how much is listening. And I sort of, I guess I probably knew what he was looking for, so I said, it's 90-10, 90% listening and 10% speaking. And that's really what it is. I'll tell you a story. There was a girl who was on the campus, and I wanted to get her to the bay. So I told her, come to my house tonight. Let's sit down. I'll make you some hot chocolate. I want to talk to you about something. Now, in those days, I used to make meetings for an hour. That was a mistake. I don't make hour-long meetings anymore. It's too long. If you sit down with a person, or they're not Magay, or they end up not being Jewish, or they're a little bit Meshuggah, you don't want to be pissed off for hours. I make half-an-hour meetings, and if they're Geshmak, you can always extend. Plus, if you say, hey, let's sit down for 20 minutes, half an hour, they'll be much more likely to have coffee with you for 20 minutes than, hey, let's go from 2 to 3. 2 to 3 is just, it's a little bit long. So I make a 20 minutes, half an hour. But in those days, I used to make hour-long meetings. She comes over to the house, and after about 5 minutes, I already knew her from campus. We had already had some sort of dialogue. So she knew me. So after about 5 minutes, I just decide to spring on her the question. And I say, look, I'm taking a group to Israel this summer. I'd love you to come. It's for a few weeks. Would you like to come to Israel with us? And she said, can't do it, I'm going to China. She went to China for her courses, her classes. So I'm thinking, oh darn, here I am, 55 minutes left to the meeting. She can't come to Israel. Now what am I going to speak about with her? And I was sort of trapped because like she wanted to have this meeting. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to work on the listening. And I started to do a lot of listening, and she's talking to me about her classes and her Weight Watchers. Like, it's just painful. But she's going on and on, listening. Oh, I hear that. What a challenge. That's amazing. And I'm listening, active listening, for almost an hour. Near the end of the hour, she looks up at me and she says, tell me, what were the dates again for that Israel trip? I think maybe I can go. I never even brought it up again. But the power of listening is devastating. Right? That's why people pay $250 an hour, because people are not heard. So if you can give listening to the next person, if you can be a great listener, you have all the power in the world. So when you sit down, coffee with that person, or even at the Shabbos table, believe me, you will be claiming the person a lot quicker by engaging that person and listening than by standing up and giving that big tartar that's going to wow them, it's going to change their life. No, listening is going to change their life if you can do that. Now, even more so, let me tell you why listening is so critical to being kind to people. It's sort of a mantra that I fall into myself as well when it comes to hearing. Sometimes we think we listen, but we didn't hear. For example, sitting in front of this girl, she says, you know, I think that the Orthodox treat their, you know, they look down on women. Now, the Makarev in me says, oh, okay, let's hit her with all the information we've got about Tzari Yemeinu, Kol Asher, Tomer Lachem Tzari Shema V'Koyla, and let's speak about Miriam, and let's speak about Devorah, and let's pile it on. If I would have done that, maybe she would have heard, yeah, no. But instead, I did listening. Now, this is a very particular kind of listening. I did pulling listening. Pulling listening means I'm going to say just enough feedback to get her to speak more. So she'll say, I think the Orthodox just have it out for women. And I said, oh, really? Why do you think so? I just think they don't know how to listen to women, and they don't treat women with respect. Wow, you've seen that? No, I'm pulling her. She said, yeah, I've seen, you know, like I've been to synagogue, and I know they don't let the women be part of services. Wow, and how does that make you feel? Well, therapist, how does that make you feel? She goes, you know, it's terrible. You know, I, how can a woman, you know, my mom's a cantor. Oh, that's what this is about. So it's not, I don't like the way Orthodox treat women. It's, I'm attacking her mother, which means I'm attacking her. And I never would have found that out if I was running, jumping to the conclusion like, okay, now let's explain to you why Judaism doesn't, is masha women. I would have missed the boat, because I didn't hear where she was coming from. Most people who have their issues with Frumkeit is because they heard certain things that hit them hard in their own lives. And that leads us to the next point. There are three things that you don't speak about in the beginning of your Kiruv of your kiruva relationship with people. You avoid them like the plague. These are the three key things you avoid, avoid, avoid. Number one, don't speak about denominations within Yiddishkeit. Don't speak about Orthodox, Reform, Conservative, Chabad, Breslov, Tzion. Ignore it. Don't speak about it. You know why? Because no matter what happens, you are attacking them on a personal level. You know why? They're not from. So they certainly, even if they're not religious at all, they may consider themselves Reform, and maybe their parents are, maybe their grandparents, maybe their cousins, and maybe the rabbi who bar mitzvahed them or bat mitzvahed them was a Reform, and you're attacking them. And once you attack them, then even if you explain, oh, don't you understand how Reform began, or they promised they were going to close down every shul in 25 years, and this Russia, Abraham Geiger, and so, what are you going to do? You'll win the battle and lose the war? And if you want to make this cloud a much larger call, here's how the call goes. In Kiruv, don't go negative. Don't go negative. If when you go negative, you're done. You lost. And the strange thing is, in Yeshiva, when we learn, part of what we do is we want to find out what's real and what's not real, what's emes and what's sheker, and we learn Musar, we're stuck with ourselves. But if we're stuck with this potential about tshuva, and we go negative, and this is sheker, and this is wrong. Think about it for a moment. If you ever watched a political debate, like in the beginning, before you only have two candidates left, you got a whole group of candidates. So sometimes you have this one candidate who is the know-it-all, abrasive person. They're the smartest person on the panel, but there's something about them that just it repels you. They're know-it-all. They're snooty. They're just something about them, and they'll put down, they'll make conniving comments, right? They say Al Gore, by one of his debates, when he really lost to George Bush, he lost it all because of a big debate. And it was during this debate, when George Bush was speaking, Al Gore was standing there rolling his eyes. Oh, what a dummy, what an idiot. And he kept doing it, and although Al Gore was clearly smarter intellectually than George Bush, you know, that's on record, but I think he's no longer president. But Al Gore came off as a know-it-all, and that just rebelled people. Then again, if you're a good politician, there's always this one guy who knows exactly what to say when it's his turn for the panel. He'll say, fellas, why don't we all just get along? Let's put aside our differences and work towards the greater cause, because I think if we got along and we try to make it a better nation together and we stop fighting so much, that's all gibberish. They all believe the same thing, but everyone's going to love this guy because the power of positivity is very, very strong. The power of negativity is terrible. And I find that a lot of people who go into Kiruv, but they come from a more yeshivish background, have that problem. They go negative very, very quickly. As a matter of fact, yesterday when I spoke in Muncie, one of the people said, is there any way to undo what I've done? Because I always went negative. I really alienated a lot of people. And we have to go into that issue. It's a very, very devastating thing to go negative. So whatever you do, don't speak about denominations. And I'll be honest with you, I fall into it. I do. I remember once I was actually speaking about not going negative. And then they asked me about a certain denomination, and in the same talk, I slipped into it. I couldn't believe myself. But that's who we are. We go negative. So whatever you do, stay away from going negative. Number two, stay away from women's issues. Now, this is particularly true if you're a man, but if you're a woman as well. The reality is that men have been terrible to women throughout history. It's just a fact. They always have. And when a man stands up and tries to justify why the Torah says certain things about women, what the potential Baal Teshuva is going to hear is, okay, this is the new excuse why it's okay to treat women poorly. So for men, absolutely, just deflect. By the way, you got to learn how to deflect if you're going to be in Kiruv. Deflection goes like this, just got to go like that. So someone says, and I'll give you an example about different denominations, and if you want to see the great deflection, watch the press secretary, the press secretary of the president. They become press secretaries because they know how to deflect. It's a great art. So when someone comes to you and they say, Reform, you know, what do you guys have against the Reform? You know, you don't consider their conversion a conversion, so you want to right away launch it. Well, doesn't have a bed, and they did it on the Calvinists. They're not ready for it. They just came to you. And plus, they probably have Reform conversion. You should check that out. You know, it's a little sermon there. But as far as what Nando said, you know what? I don't like to speak about the other denominations. You know, I just try to grow as a person myself. Boom, you deflected it. Right? And what do you think about how we just like, you know, we love people. What do you think about the more you learn how to deflect, and it's not that difficult to deflect. You just say, you know, I'm not comfortable speaking about this. Or, you know what, that's a great topic. We've got to get into it, but I think we've got to get more of a foundation before we attack this particular concept. Deflect it. Deflect it. It's not there. You'll get to it. If you can deflect, then you can control the conversation. If you can't deflect, you can't control. So the second thing is women's issues. If you're a man, don't speak about it. If you're a woman, also don't speak about it. Now, let me explain to you why. It's sort of a tiefe Sache. It took me a few years to really get it. And here's how the call goes. The attitude that we have and the halachas that we have regarding the role of women in Yiddishkeit usually does not have to do with one reason or one particular halacha. Usually it's a conglomeration or an amalgamation of a different reasons combined. Now, let me explain what I mean. I'll give you an example, okay? Someone once asked me, let me ask you, why is it, does Yiddishkeit have the death penalty? Can you get the death penalty in Yiddishkeit? And we, the answer is yes. The Torah says, you get the death penalty. So they say, really? You get the death penalty? So, of course, then we smile and say, yes, but you know how hard it is to get the death penalty? And then we say, well, you have to have eight. They have Asra, and they have to be Kosher Edom, they can't be Kroivim, and Asra has to be, you have to tell them the right kind of Nisan, has to be Kosher Edom, and they have to say Abal Pikein, and so on and so forth. As a matter of fact, a Besen that kills once in 70 years is considered a Besen Kaplanis. So then the student said, well, let me ask you, well, then what's the point? What's the point of having? What's the point of having a death penalty that you can't actually issue? What's the point? It's a good question, right? What is the point? Well, I saw it. The point. Here's the point. It's a brilliant point. The point is that by a yid just knowing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would allow the death penalty for doing certain actions if all the circumstances were correct, that is the deterrent. That is the deterrent. To know that if I'm the Chal Shabbat Chas V'Shalom, I'd be Chai of Nisa. There's no best and there's no Sanhedrin. But to know that Hashem would say that what I'm doing is so bad that my life is forfeit, that is the deterrent. If I were to take the very same halachas, yeah, Edom and Asra, and as we touched the Dibur and so on and so forth, and say those are the halachas of getting the death penalty in Harlem, do you think that would be a deterrent? Absolutely not. It wouldn't be. Not in Manhattan, not in the Bronx, nowhere. Why? So here's the rule. The rule goes like this. Yiddishkeit works in a Yiddish environment. Judaism works for Jews. For a Jew, having the potential of getting the death penalty works as a deterrent. It doesn't work for the non-Jewish world. It was never supposed to. Okay? That's sort of how the combination works. When it comes to women's issues, there's no one reason why, for example, a woman cannot be a rabbi. But you see a lady, you say, well, why can't I be a rabbi? What would you answer? Why can't? Well, Kalisha, it's not theistic. The answer is there are many answers. And when all those things are combined, Klai Yisrael made a decision together, this is just not what the women are going to do. If you just say, well, she should be in time, so that's why she's not a rabbi, but I think I could be a rabbi and I will be, and I'll be very theistic about it. I mean, I am allowed to go to shul, so it's just a matter, I'm not in my house anyway, so why can't I cross over? Right? Oh, it's not theistic. Well, I'm very old. What are people going to look at me? I mean, whatever you say, someone's going to give an answer, and you're going to get stuck. So the answer is that it's a conglomeration. It's a mixture of all the different reasons that form the attitude. Okay, that's why, that's the general call by the women's issues. When China answered, I once made this mistake, I was in front of a raving feminist, and I tried to give an answer like that, and she chopped me to pieces, because it's not one answer, that's the truth. The truth is it's not one answer, it's a combination. The third thing we never speak about is homosexuality. We don't do it, we don't do it. It is the hot button topic of our generation, and no matter what you say, you are going to look bad, you're going to look wrong. You cannot win that argument, even if you explain it. And part of it is because, never fly to death, the generation we're living in, the person you're speaking to, if they themselves are not one, then they have a brother, they have a sister, an uncle, an aunt, somebody, a best friend. Today, it's so out there that you absolutely will come away looking bad. So we avoid it. It doesn't mean we don't have an answer. Of course we have an answer. Of course we do. There are a number of very good books on the topic, but we don't address it. There's not the time. There's a lot to speak about. It is 10 o'clock. Go by my watch. Okay, we've got 3 more minutes to 10. Okay, we'll leave the 3 minutes to 10. When a person asks you a question, it's really critical to know that that question makes assumptions. Never answer the question until you understand the assumption behind the question. And the best thing to do is to attack the assumption. If someone were to tell you, ask you a question, why is it okay for Israel to bomb civilians? Why does Israel feel it's okay to bomb civilians? So, if you try to answer that question, well, they feel it's okay because Hamas terrorists are hiding, you're already lost. You agreed with their assumption that Israel feels okay. It's not true. Israel feels terrible about it. They try everything in their power that they shouldn't bomb. You have to know what the assumptions are. Usually there is baggage, and it's an interesting thing. Interviewers do this all the time. They craft the question in a way that they get certain answers. There was even a little video that a man made where he dressed up like an Israeli, and he went around the streets of Manhattan asking questions. Who do you think is right in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? And he was dressed like an Israeli and asking people in an Israeli accent, little yarmulke on, and everyone said Israel. And then he got dressed up like an Arab, and he went around the same streets of Manhattan, interviewing. Everyone said the Palestinians. Because people want to please, they try to figure out, what does he want me to say? Okay, that's what he wants me to say. So therefore, questions have baggage. How it's presented. So if a person says, why do bad things happen to good people? And there is so much assumption in that question. There are so many parentheses, I don't even know where to begin. Okay, for one moment, let's explore what that question was asking. Why do bad things happen to good people? So, of course, we all know, well, you're assuming that they're bad things, and you're assuming that you're a good person. Right? There's an infamous person named Harold Kushner who wrote a book called Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People. The question only occurred to him after he never lost the son. And his parents, it must be Hashem doesn't run the world anymore. He created the world and then let it fly on its own. But there's a lot more to that question. First of all, well, why don't you just answer very simply, bad things happen to good people? Because maybe Hashem is not as good as you think. Maybe Hashem just doesn't care. Right? Maybe, why are you assuming? Why is it even a question to you? Maybe there's no Hashem. If there's no Hashem, so you're assuming there is Hashem. Otherwise, no question. Bad things happen to good people because it's chaotic. So you believe there's Hashem. Okay, so why is it a question to you? Because you look around the world, you see a lot of good, and now you see a stira. That's your question. Well, when you say, why do bad things happen to good people? This is what the parentheses look like. Not why do bad things happen to good people, but why can't I understand why bad things happen to good people? Because that's really what you're asking. You don't want to know why. You're assuming there's a reason. Otherwise, no question. So you're saying, well, why can't I understand that reason? Well, there's another parenthesis that is hidden in that question, but that's there. Here's how it goes. Why can't I understand why God makes bad things happen to good people? Because if you take God out of the equation, then again, it's not a question. So now we need a working definition for God, because then you and I are talking about different beings. What's your working definition for God? Well, the person will say, omnipotent, omniscient, all-powerful, all-knowing. Okay, good. But what's that? I need a working definition for I. Why can't I understand? Who are you? Are you omnipotent, omniscient? Not likely, right? You're neither. You're not all-knowing. So really what you're asking, let's put all the practices together. Why can't I, who knows not all that much, who has no idea of how the world is composed, does not know the past, know the future, why can't I understand why God, who is omnipotent and omniscient, does what he does? The answer is because he is and you're not. And the question is answered right away. That's the answer. The answer is, right? The gap between me and God is a much, much greater gap than between me and my three-year-old. And my three-year-old does not understand why I pay taxes. He doesn't understand why I do any of the things that I do. And the gap between Hashem and us is much, much greater than between me and the three-year-old. So that's the answer. The answer is looked in the question. So you always have to figure out, listen very carefully to the question, and you can figure out what is going on. Okay, maybe I'll say one last thing. Okay. When we opened up our house, had a lot of guests. So originally it was meant for Baal Teshuva. As time went on, we ended up having more people come. Some were not Baal Teshuva, some were from, went off the derech, some were kids at risk. And then as it evolved, now we have chassidim come. I mean, the house is just like it's a challah. And everyone's having a good time, and they're singing and they're dancing. We're very into singing and dancing in our home. It's a big thing. Shalom Aleichem Friday night, we all dance around the table. Our Havdalah takes a half an hour. We're singing, and then the kids go on our shoulders and we dance. The power of song is not used, and it must be used. It speaks to the heart, and it's just amazing what you can do. This group was by us this past Shabbos. They've been here since Monday, and they were like dead. They came to the house Friday night, and they just didn't look like they were into it. So I usually choose my song of the Shabbos, and I just do it over and over. The Shabbos, it was Shweki's Ma Ma Ma. That was it, Ma Ma Ma. And after a few minutes, the whole table are banging, and they're cheering, and they're singing, and they're dancing, and the whole Shabbos changed. By the time Shabbos was over, we have a speaker system throughout the house. I put on the actual tape, and the whole place went nuts. The dance and the singing. That is the power of song. It's so chashuv. But why is it that we have these kind of people come to our home and they're just not feeling their own Yiddishkeit? They grew up from it. So let me tell you something that I tell my kids again and again and again and again. And it's, you know, one of the most important insights in all of Yiddishkeit. And it is this. Judaism is not a religion. Yiddishkeit is not a religion. It is a relationship. It's a relationship. This is the most important words that you'll hear tonight. Judaism is not a religion, it's a relationship. Say it again and again. How many times is Judaism called a religion in the Torah? The Haman called us a religion, but we don't call ourselves a religion. Who calls us a religion? It's interesting, if you ever look at the translation of the Quran, Islam calls itself a religion again and again and again and again and again. There's no religion like Islam, there's no God like... Right? That they call themselves a religion again and again. It's not a religion, it's a relationship. And once you understand that, then your approach towards Yiddishkeit is completely different. How many times is Yiddishkeit called a relationship in the Torah? Hundreds of times. Hundreds. B'ni b'chayri Yisrael, im yelet shashun, kimi degavilo, mashkech minachalonos, makes minacharakim. Again and again, relationship, maldinu malkein. It's all about a relationship. So if you go about your Yiddishkeit like it's a religion, now we stand up, now we sit down, now we patch ourselves here, and now we eat this. So after a while, you feel like a zombie, you feel like you're obsessive, compulsive, and you lose the cheshit. But if you're in a relationship, then you want to do it for the other people in the relationship, all that you can do. Someone asked me yesterday, why do we eat chicken? Why do we eat chicken with milk? I said, that's my favorite question in all of Yiddishkeit. I love that question. Why would I? Because she meant to cause me problems. She meant to say, chicken's not meat. Right? I love that question because it defines who we are as human. You know who we are? I said, if I go jogging in the morning, that's sigh, I lose weight, go jogging in the morning, the first morning that I go jogging, I'm putting on my shoes, and my wife is a light sleeper, and I wake her up, but she can't pull back to sleep, the next morning, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I'm going to take those shoes and put them outside the room so I can put them on quietly. Why don't I just put them on in the same room? This time I'll try to be more quietly. You know why? Because I don't want to house the shalom and wake her up again. If you're in a relationship, you don't want an oops. You don't want an oops. Because that means you love the other person. Right? I don't want to even take a chance. That's what not even chicken and milk means. Yes, most of the time I can tell the difference between meat and chicken, but I'm not. It's going to be made into a patty. It's going to be a hot dog and a barbecue, and I'm not going to know was it meat, was it chicken. I love Hashem too much to have an ox. I'm in a relationship. I'm not in a religion. If I'm in a religion, yeah, by the letter of the law. I did the best I could. Now you're in a relationship. There's love there. And the highest form of a relationship, Shir Hashir, is a relationship of a lover. So I'm in love with Hashem. Madly in love with the one above. That's how I feel. So therefore, each and every mitzvah that I'm going to do, do I have to do it? Do I not have to do it? You know what? I want to do it. If that's your attitude towards Yiddishkeit, then Yiddishkeit is alive. I want to extend Shabbos. I want to spend a little more time with Hashem. I'm not in a rush. It was 72 minutes. Okay, get the computer on. I'm done. No! Spend a little more time. Spend more time with the family. Spend a little more time with the mirrors. Because I'm in a relationship. And when there are good dharma, I say, oh, that's an abundant. I can be made like this. Because I love Hashem. And that's our attitude. Of course we have to know. And of course Hashem is Avinu. And I think he's Malkeinu. And I have to, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not a Mevater. And I still have to do what Halacha is. But that's all in order to build a relationship. People come off the derech. From people. Simply because they don't look at Yiddishkeit like a religion. They look at it like a religion. That's what Haman wanted to do to us. Religion. Do's and don'ts. That's Reform and Conservative today. It's all religion. Religions are based out of a synagogue, a temple. So go to a temple, religion's in the temple, you go home, that's it. If you're in a relationship, whether you're in front of your spouse or not, you're still in love. You do what you need to do in order to connect. If you can convey this to the person you're in front of, then you're going to win them over. You tell them, I feel you have a relationship with Hashem. Hashem says to do this and that. I want to understand it because that's going to deepen the relationship. And if I don't understand it yet, sometimes, you know, the person says, I'm a Jew at heart. I feel it in my heart. I feel like you get that a lot. I feel like I'm a good Jew at heart. I said, that's not a relationship. You know, if my wife has cereal and I'm running out to Pathmark to buy something, and she says, oh, you're going there? You know, can you go buy me some milk. If you don't mind, buy me some milk. And I go to Pathmark, and I see beautiful roses. So I buy the roses, I come home, and she opens the door, and I say, darling, these are for you. And she smells, delicious. Did you bring me the milk? I didn't have money for both. I just figured roses. She said, I appreciate the roses, but I needed the milk. Part of being in a relationship is doing not just for yourself what makes you feel like you're in the relationship, but finding out what the other person in the relationship needs out of the relationship. That's the Jewish heart. That means you're not in a relationship with Hashem. That means you're in a relationship with yourself. That's it in a sweet way. You can't hammer them over that, but that's what you want to convey. Anyhow, I'm quite a bit over. Should they have questions or is there any? If you want, don't feel hostage here, please. If you have any questions. If you have any questions,